From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a tragedy on the football field. Well, on the practice field, really. On May 29th at the University of Maryland, 19-year-old offensive lineman Jordan McNair was airlifted to a Baltimore hospital after collapsing during a team workout. He died 2 weeks later. McNair had collapsed after a conditioning test that consisted of 10 110-yard sprints during an off-season workout. Now, the law firm hired by McNair's family said it has corroborating evidence that suggests McNair was showing signs of heat stroke before he completed the 110-yard sprints. According to the Baltimore Sun, the University of Maryland's president met with McNair's family last Tuesday morning in Baltimore to apologize and to take legal and moral responsibility for the circumstances leading to the football player's death. Care was not provided consistent with best practices, the university said. Well, Maryland football coach DJ Durkin and three members of his staff were placed on administrative leave amid allegations of a toxic culture within the football program. The school announced last Tuesday that it had parted ways with strength and conditioning coach Rick Court. ESPN published an investigation into the culture at Maryland and found that coaches regularly belittle athletes, mock their weight, and engage in what appears to be verbal and emotional abuse. They use food in odd ways. They try to motivate, they say. The idea, according to the various sources who talked to ESPN, is to make the athletes tougher, to motivate them to achieve more than they thought they could. But is that what football culture should be about? And more importantly, how prevalent is this approach at the high school and college level? You know one phrase we hear often in stories like this? Be a man. What does it mean to be a man? Our guest today will help us understand what masculinity means on the field, at practice, and in the locker room. We're joined by, in studio, Andre Fontanet, a 2004 Syracuse University graduate and a former SU wide receiver. Andre, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you here in studio.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Derek DeSole. He's a former St. John College football player, among many other hats he wears in our community. Derek, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also with us here in studio is Mark Primus, who's a clinical assistant professor of social work at Nazareth College. Mark, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And with us on the line is Roland Williams, a Super Bowl champion and founder of the Champion Academy. Roland, nice to have you back on the program. How are you?
Spectacular.
Well, let me start with you, Roland, and I'll ask our guests this in the various ways in which they interpret this. You know, when ESPN reports that it wasn't just a one-off story of, you know, a hot day and a player collapses, that the coaching staff was regularly belittling, that the culture felt, according to a lot of sources on the record and off the record to ESPN, it felt pretty toxic. How common was that in your experience as an athlete, Roland?
Well, you know, the game of football inherently is a violent sport that requires a shift, a departure from sort of your normal day-to-day operations. And unfortunately, there are a lot of coaches that take the concept of the game and take it beyond the normal structure that needs to be to perform well. And during my career, you know, we had some coaches that definitely were aggressive. During my high school days, we had people that were definitely aggressive. Of course, in the pros, when there's jobs on the line, people took things to the extreme. And I do believe that's something that desperately needs to be improved across the board in our football culture.
Andre, how often did you see that kind of approach from coaching staffs in your athletic career?
Well, I noticed Roland said it happened to him in high school and it happened to him in the pro level. And Roland and I went to Syracuse. What's up, Ro?
What up?
And I can speak at that level, at the college level. I personally never had any kind of experience like that, nor had I witnessed anybody being verbally assaulted or anything like that. I mean, they were tough on us, but there was never anything that happened that made me feel that anybody was being abused. But we certainly ran 110s and did conditioning and off-season workouts
sure.
in the heat. And there was never any issue. There were trainers out there and things like that. So for me, it was to hear this story is certainly not normal.
Okay. Derek, in your experience, not only as a former college football player, but as someone who's been in touch with a lot of athletes at different levels, how often did you hear stories like this?
Well, I think fortunately, there's still the outlier. And in my own experience at St. John Fisher, you know, at the Division III level, perhaps it's a little bit different. And the same thing, though. You want to be competitive. You want to be tough. You're going to be challenged. But we were never abused. Thank goodness we had a very positive culture. It was a culture of accountability. And so when you messed up, you knew you were letting the guys down. You knew you were letting the coaching staff down. And that was really drilled in. And it wasn't this, what I'm reading here, thank goodness this is an outlier. And I hope it still is. Obviously, my last season was 15 years ago, which makes me feel not young. But I really do hope that this is still the exception, and that's why it's news.
Yeah, and Professor Primus, I think in this case, it's valuable to ask you where you see the line between, as Derek said, and as Andre said, and as Roland says, you get pushed as an athlete, but they didn't, at least Andre not at the college level, Derek not at the college level, they didn't feel abused. The difference between pushing an athlete to get more out of them and abusing an athlete and then saying, well, that's just, you know, learning how to be a man, be a man. How do we draw lines like that?
Well, it's very difficult in terms of trying to do that, but because our ideas of gender and gender socialization really pushes that concept. And so however we decide as a society to do that, we see that come out on the field. So we know that within the structure of just looking at this idea of, okay, we have this structure, this culture within this game. And so when we are pushing that idea, we've already kind of structured that somehow prior to that idea. So we structured that way when they were younger.
We socialized that?
Right, to say that, you know, this is how you become that. And in that sense, become a man, become a person that is going to be someone that we look up to say that, okay, you're doing a great job on the field, you're doing a great job here in your home, you're doing a great job wherever it might be. But the socialization of masculinity is very, very important to try to kind of tease out that ends up to be where we are right now when we're looking at this whole idea of what's happening within the structure of this conversation.
Is this connected to... is this too far afield, or is this connected to my amazement when I watched last week? I was on vacation, was with my six-year-old. He was riding a bike. I was riding my bike, and an acquaintance said to him, "Hey, nice bike." And he said, "Thanks." And he said, "Your dad's got a girly bike." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Why is it girly?" "Because it has a pink stripe." And the acquaintance said, "Yeah, it's girly." And my son said, "There's no such thing as girly colors, girly bikes, that you just made that up." But, you know, there are people trying to teach him that if there's a pink stripe on a bike, that's for a girl. Is that related to this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we socialize children from gender type toys, if it's a Tonka or a Barbie, from gender type toys to just looking at this concept of how you present yourself as a gender. You know, which obviously we know it's socially constructed. But however, the sex of a child is directly associated with genitalia, which is the gendered piece. So we will construct that, you know, if you're a male and you have the particular genitalia / sex, therefore you have to have these particular behaviors. And so we perpetuate that throughout society. So therefore, we will end up, there's no way that it could not be that outcome. We will end up with that outcome if we perpetuate this idea.
Roland, for you, when you see athletes who want to become successful, and success can mean different things, you know, at different levels. I mean, as Derek mentioned, a D3 athlete is probably not thinking about going pro, but you want to be successful. You want to win games. You want to improve. And maybe athletes like yourself and Andre had different goals in terms of the outcome here. But how do you, when you are working with young people, Roland, whatever their goals are, help them distinguish between healthy approach to working hard and succeeding versus getting caught up, as the professor just mentioned here, in what society has told people men are supposed to do? Men are not supposed to be emotional. Men are supposed to be tough. Men have to hit hard. You know, men have to suck it up when things aren't going. How do you distinguish between that, Roland?
Well, it's interesting you say that. You know, as a father, you know, I'm a dad now, and I have three sons. My oldest in the 10th grade, middle son, 7th grader. My youngest is a 1st grader. And the concept and the notion of how you define success, how you define masculinity, these ideas, and no different than the kids I mentor in the Champion Academy, they come from mentorship. They come from the people that you're around and the thoughts, words, and actions that come from each of them. And so, you know, there is an amazing book by Joe Erman called Inside Out Coaching. And in this book, one of the key principles is the difference between transactional coaching versus transformational. Transactional versus transformational, and how these issues of abuse come up in sports. And I want to make sure I put this in and departmentalize the conversation of abuse. There's more than just physical abuse, which is maybe overworking someone. There's also emotional and verbal abuse. When I look at the game of sports and that ideology of what it takes to be a good football player, far too many coaches, far too many people believe that I have to verbally berate you as a player to sort of get you motivated to be successful. That's not the case. It doesn't take a verbal assault for someone to just run around the right way or to block someone. I don't need my kids to be verbally abused in order to do that. I don't need them to be emotionally abused, meaning back when we played, and Andre, you guys may know about this, how some coaches, they don't look at you or talk to you if you're not a good player. If you're a great player, you get conversation and hello. If you're not a good player, they'll walk right by you in the hallway. Like they don't know you exist. I don't, my sons and masculinity, I don't need to you to get emotionally abused to become a good football player. And so a lot of these ideologies come from that notion of this old school, what toughness and all these things are about. And it's leaving far too many athletes, far too many males on the other side of that universe, being dysfunctional in relationships, not knowing how to cope with their emotions. And I'm actually one of those kids who had to deal with all those things now, and you have to reconcile them as an adult.
Andre, what worked for you? I ask this because to a coach like the staff at Maryland that was doing things this way, clearly they thought this is what it takes to get something great out of players. And some coaches are like that. Some coaches decide what works for one athlete works differently for another, and they try to tailor it. Some don't go down that sort of verbally abusive path at all. What worked for you in terms of actually improving and elevating your game?
Well, I don't think it worked for Maryland all that well. I think they only won like 5 games last year. So
fair.
I don't think that they're the way they're treating people obviously isn't giving them the results that they want. But what worked for me was just it's the golden rule of life that you learn as a kindergartner. Treat others the way you want to be treated. And when a kid gets recruited to go to a university, you're telling that those parents, like, we're gonna treat your son like they're our own. And, you know, I'm going to treat him just like I would my own kids. And then things like this happen. So I think that people just have to treat others how they would want to be treated in order to have a successful program, whether it's work, whether it's in business, or whether it's in sports. How you treat people is how you want others to treat people. And I read in an article on ESPN, the guy, an anonymous assistant said, I would never allow my son to be coached here. Never. And when you hear things like that, it makes you wonder, like, wow, what's really going on? But for me, it was just treat me how you would want to be treated. And if I mess up, I have no problem with you telling me, especially if I make the same mistake 2 and 3 times. But other than that, just treat me how I deserve to be treated, and we'll be fine.
That's, I think, a key distinction here, because some in our audience are going to hear what you're saying and think, oh, well, that's just soft. Kids have to be able to handle tough direction. They have to be able to handle it when they make a mistake. So draw that line for me. For you, you're not saying don't discipline. You're not saying don't get tough at times. Mm-hmm. But draw that distinction for me.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the obvious line is just saying the word abuse. You can never be abusive to anybody.
But people will say that's subjective.
And I don't think you can do that unless, if you go and look at the most successful college coaches right now, I guarantee you Nick Saban is not abusing his kids. He's hard on them. He's tough on them, especially when they need it. I can guarantee you that the people down at Auburn or even the people at Syracuse that are gaining more and more momentum right now, I guarantee you they're not being abusive to their kids. And if they are, sooner or later, it's going to come out. Sooner or later, it's going to come out in a negative light, and that's exactly what happened to Maryland. And it took a death of just simple off-season workouts to pull out all these different things that are happening and all these different emotions that are now drawing the line as to what's right and what's wrong. And I think that Maryland right now is probably one of several schools that are having issues, and this has just happened to be the ones that got caught.
Well, then let me ask our guests, and I'll start with Derek. What is okay? What is the right kind of tough love coaching that is not abusive? Where is that line for you?
Well, I think we're just becoming increasingly enlightened, not just in football, but just in life right now. We're becoming more enlightened on how we use language, on how we treat people, on how bosses treat subordinates at work. I mean, I think it's really a cultural thing, and that's the beauty of football, is that you can get a lot of those life metaphors there. And hopefully football becomes the vehicle where the best coaches, even more than they were before, the best coaches are the best teachers. And who are the best teachers? The ones that inspire you, the ones that you would never want to let down, the ones that when they're disappointed in you, that hurts more than any verbal undressing that you can get. I'd like to see that. I mean, that's the line for me, is that coach better know, at least when I played, that coach better know that he, I better know that the coach has my back, that he still cares about me as a human being, that he wants me to be a part of this team. And he's kicking my butt because he wants me to help the group.
And it's okay to say that,
right? That's right. Exactly. That is okay. That is okay to, like, look, this is a tough game, and we better be ready to play, or we're not going to win, and then that's going to be even worse. If it extends beyond to, I don't care about you as a person, that's, to me, that's where we start to teeter into abuse, where now I am not human to you. Now we've got a problem. Or if you care about me as a young man.
Or I only care about you if you produce the results that I want.
Exactly. I mean, look, I had the fortunate perspective of being a second string offensive lineman with slow feet and 5'8" most of my time at Fisher. So I knew they cared about me as a person, because it certainly wasn't my dazzling 40 time. And I think that really helped. Again, I was the guy who would grind it out in the weight room. I was the guy that I still better do it right, because when my number's called, I better get in there to play. And I knew that at the end of the day, they still wanted to know I was doing well in school, that I was staying out of trouble. Coach Vosburgh, about a year after I graduated, I was dating my now wife, who's a school teacher, and he came and spoke to her class. And he didn't have to do that. He was essentially done with me. I was out of the system. And he did that just because he cared, because he knew I needed a favor. And she was in I forget what she was putting together. It was a long time ago now. But she was really looking for a guest speaker, and he would have been a perfect fit, and he did that. He cared about me as a human being, and they all did. And I think that you can be as hard on me as you want if you know that you care about me as a person.
See, that's the difference. And Roland Williams, this is a case where maybe the media is partly culpable here, because who are some of the most famous coaches that come to – Bob Knight comes to mind. I wasn't at Indiana practice or Texas Tech practice for years, and I can't say that I know – I only know what I see reported. But he was sort of glamorized for – you know, grabbing, putting his hands around a kid's neck, and the fire and the passion. And there are people today who would march in protest in support of Bob Knight. We sort of glamorize taking it to that edge. Is the media partly culpable here, Roland?
I would say so. I think people in general like to see conflict or some kind of drama. But I like to draw your attention to other type of coaches, like a Tony Dungy. Over that coach for years, and on his field, on his first day of practice, he told every player and coach, if you must curse, if you must do anything that is inappropriate or un-Christ-like, then I'll trade you or cut you today after practice. There was no cursing allowed on his field. There was no abuse allowed on his field, and he did pretty well in his career. You know, think about a guy named Brian Shaw up at Stanford. I'm out here in the West Coast now, and to see what he's doing with his program, with students that have a higher academic threshold than any other school in the country, to watch how they practice, to watch the excellence and the love and the attention to detail and the focus, you know, and take my own career, you know, playing with Dick Vermeil and the Rams. He was like playing for your grandfather, you know, tears, emotional, hugging, passionate, loving, kind. And we still had a chance to be awfully successful. So I don't believe in that notion of all that fire and brimstone is somehow all these verbal and emotional games are somehow supposed to convert into you having better technique and running better routes and tackling and being a better player.
Do you bring up Dick Vermeil? That's an interesting one. I mean, he's known for the emotion that he showed winning and losing. And I admire him all the more for that. I've never met the man personally, but I admire that. How common or uncommon was that, Roland, to actually see emotion because of some of what Professor Primus has talked about, that sort of this culture that gets, that kind of gets sewn into us so early that tells us, especially not just that men have to be certain ways, but they can't be certain ways. They can't be emotional. They can't cry. They can't show those things. How common or uncommon was that among coaching staffs beyond Dick Vermeil?
Well, I'll say that it was the rule. And unfortunately, like I can be a living testimony, that notion, and not only in football, but also at home, not being allowed to cry. Like, you know, men crying is like this thing that you cannot do. But I will tell you, based off of the research, based off my own experiences, based off of life, if you can't cry physically, you'll cry in other ways. You'll cry out with some of your behaviors and relationships. You'll cry out with academic failure. You'll cry out with some of the challenges you face or some of the aggression you show in the game of football. And so we all need outlets, healthy outlets for our emotional well-being. And in the culture of football, unfortunately, historically, it wasn't allowed to be shown in certain ways, like crying, right, or too much hugging and things like that. And so, again, I believe as a dad that this culture needs to evolve. And not to say that, you know, that I love the game of football. I love playing it hard and tough and the discipline and the attention to detail. But I think it can be done without crossing the line of being abusive.
Yeah, and Roland, I know you got to go. So let me just tell you where my mind goes as you talk about this here. I think about the fact that it was just about the same summer that Jim Valvano was giving his speech at the ESPYs that still gets replayed, where he says, if you laugh every day, if you think every day, and if you cry every day, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day. This is a coach who was dying, knew that he had months to live, and that speech still gets replayed. Right around the same time, one of the biggest movies in theaters was A League of Their Own, in which one of the most famous moments of that movie is Tom Hanks, the coach of this team, telling one of the women players, there's no crying. There's no crying in baseball. The subtext there is, you're playing a man's sport. You can't cry because men don't cry. And it was supposed to be a funny moment, but the subtext was, no crying. Masculinity means no crying, and if you're playing a sport that's a man's sport and you don't cry, it just, the juxtaposition is very interesting. And I guess I'll ask you before you go to tell us if you think that we are going in a better or a worse direction with athletics in helping people see that, yes, men can cry, and no, we don't have to be abusive. What kind of direction do you think we're going in, Roland?
I think we're going in a great direction, and I think it's led by the athletes themselves. I think you've seen now more than any time in history, athletes showing that they have hearts, athletes showing that they stand for social and emotional, social issues, seeing them care for emotional issues, seeing them stand up for family and promote that as what's right. And so one of the greatest stories I've seen in recent history has been LeBron James and his commitment to education and doing things in his hometown, which I can completely relate to. And so I think this is what's going to change the culture is when it comes from the inside out.
Roland, as always, thanks for the time. I know you got a split. Thanks for taking the time for the program today.
All right, guys.
All right, Ro.
Roland Williams is a Super Bowl champion and founder of the Champion Academy. We're talking about not just what happened at the University of Maryland, in which a 19-year-old sophomore athlete died after collapsing during an off-season drill, but we're talking about the ESPN report that showed that the University of Maryland has allegedly, at least, a pretty toxic football culture there. The coaches, the way they berate and approach players, and the expectations on how the players handle some of that, what our guests are calling abuse. How prevalent is that? What does that say about athletic culture? What does that say about the culture of what we expect boys to become and what that means? We're talking to Derek DeSole, who's a former St. John Fisher College football player, Andre Fontenette, Syracuse University grad and former SU football player, Mark Primus, a clinical assistant professor of social work at Nazareth College. John and Webster, we're going to come to you, and we're going to take more phone calls when we come back here. So let's tell you the phone number. We'd love to hear from you on this, not just about football, but how it connects to how we raise boys and girls, men and women, the expectations, and the differences in sex, gender, and what we are teaching at a young age and what it becomes when they become adults. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, the Seneca Park Zoo Society is getting ready to host their inaugural Environmental Innovation Awards and Symposium. Zoos these days are a lot more than just homes for animals. They're working on conservation, and they're looking for who is doing the hard environmental innovation work in our community. Who's leading the way? We're going to discuss that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get John in Webster on the phone first. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Evan. Great program. What I heard about the coaches at Maryland just sound like the drill sergeants I had almost 53 years ago when I went to Marine Corps OCS. Plus, just, I mean, amazing language, foul language that you just wouldn't realize, but they were never allowed to touch us. We never had to run. We had to do maybe 100 push-ups or 150 if we'd done something wrong. But the getting in your face and belittling, that was everything that they did back then to get us through OCS. I didn't like it one bit, but I volunteered because I was getting my citizenship through the Marines. But I consider it one of the worst experiences of my life. Wow. To go through all of that.
One of the worst, you said?
Yes.
Do you in any way, John, think, you know, I didn't like it at the time, but I look back and I understand it?
No.
Interesting.
No, I don't. I never thought there was a need for it. Of course, I was a philosopher and not a big guy going in for the Marines, even though I was 6'4" and 210 pounds. I had a totally different attitude, I guess, because of the humanities. But I thought it was totally unnecessary that they had to be better ways to get us to conform to the rigor and the things that they wanted us in the Marine Corps.
Okay, well, let me just say, John, and I'll ask you this question. I was going to ask our panel, but I'll start with you, and then we'll direct it to the panel because it's of a thread here. I got an email from a listener named Mike who told me that that I would be laughed out of the military if I brought this attitude in, and that a lot of our guests just don't get it. So you did serve, and Mike is emailing to tell me that this conversation is indicative of a lack of understanding of the value of discipline and that I would be laughed out of the military. He said, I'm assuming, Evan, you didn't serve. That's correct. I've never served for the U.S. Armed Forces. So he says I would be laughed out. So go ahead, John. What would you say to Mike?
Yeah, you wouldn't succeed, and we had a lot that didn't succeed back then. But to get through, you just had to bite your tongue, cry at night in your bunk, and get through it. And my goal was, of course, to get citizenship in 3 years instead of waiting for five. Mm-hmm. And it worked for me. But I looked back on that, and I told my sons I never wanted them to go through that. And I told my grandsons the same thing. But I have to say that my youngest son is a very good football player, or was. He has three sons, and he's always told them there's no crying in football. And I've just had to bite my tongue and say nothing about it.
Well, thank you, John. Thanks for sharing that story. And interesting that you look back and you don't find, in retrospect, the wisdom that some would hope that you would. But thank you, as always, John, for the phone call. Let me turn that to our guest then. And Professor Primus, I'll start with you. What do you make of the conflicting viewpoints, one from John, who's remembering his service five decades ago, and then another from a listener named Mike who says that we've gone soft and we don't get it and we'd be laughed out of the military?
Well, just in the idea of discipline, firstly, I had just completed some research that really just pushes this idea of, and it had to do with children and discipline. And it always showed, regardless of if it's within the context of the United States or globally, that when you use some form of abuse within your discipline, it never has positive outcomes. Just never. It's just beyond anything that we have done in terms of looking at the research and trying to figure it out. It's always been that the outcomes are all negative. Psychologically, socially, academically, it's always a negative for them. So even within the idea of raising children and disciplining children with physical discipline, and then you're getting into the idea of when you're looking at someone within the idea of being in the military at 18, I guess, plus years of age, then if we have already created this context of discipline, and this is the way it happens within our structure of discipline, then we expect that that's what should be happening. So therefore, we expect, oh, you should berate someone, you should physically, psychologically abuse someone within that context. And within the idea of discipline, it's still the same. So if it's a child, you're doing that as a parent with a child, or even if it's a drill sergeant doing that as you are in the military, it's still the same. Disciplining within the context of physically just or psychologically within the context of being older, it's just still just the same. There's no positive outcomes.
Andre, what do you make of those two conflicting viewpoints from our listeners?
Well, I just think about when you get recruited. I go back to that point, you know you're doing something wrong, you'll hide it. You know, you won't talk about it. When this young man who passed away got recruited by Maryland, I guarantee you when he went up on his official visit and maybe even during the springtime and they're practicing, I guarantee you those days, those coaches weren't sitting there yelling and screaming at the kids like crazy. They weren't berating them. They weren't swearing at them. They weren't abusing them.
They were putting on a show for the recruits.
And then you put on a front. You know, and then all of a sudden you get these kids to commit, and then they come to the university, and then it becomes so hard to transfer out because you're stuck in a bad situation. You're like, you know, what do you do? And a lot like your first caller said, you know, a lot of times you just got to suck it up and take it. You know, but I would say to somebody who doesn't agree, I would just say, you know, you would have to live it. Me personally, I didn't live in that situation, but I can guarantee you that it happens, and I wouldn't want to. If you would want to put yourself or your child through that situation, then more power to you. But I don't imagine that caller, or excuse me, that writer, or anybody else would want to put themselves or their children or grandchildren in that situation.
Okay. Derek?
Well, I think if you depend on repercussions from others, if you depend on being punished, you're not disciplined. Discipline comes from within. And so if I'm only doing the things that I'm supposed to be doing for fear of punishment, I'm not disciplined. If I'm doing the things I'm supposed to be doing because I know this is a goal we're trying to achieve, this is my piece of the puzzle, and I better be as prepared as I can be for it, then I'm disciplined. And when am I going to do that? When I care about the people involved, when I care about what's going on, when I'm invested in doing it. So in a football team, I want to get playing time, or I want to start, or I want to help us win the league or advance however we're going to advance, depending on where you're playing. And I want to make sure my guys have the best teammate they have. And I want to make sure my coaches, their belief in me is validated. That's discipline. To say, coach is going to make me run till I throw up, that is not discipline. And furthermore, in the military, you're 18 years old, and you're being prepared to enter kill or be killed situations. That's not football. It's antiquated, and it's happened as long as football has been around, where we've had military, analogies to it, and it's not appropriate. And for every youth football coach who runs a bunch of 9-year-olds out there and fantasizes that he's Bear Bryant coaching the Junction Boys in 1950, there really needs to be a check there, because that's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, we had a caller named Dan who wanted to call in and say that exactly the point Derek is making here, that even just the military language, the Bill show is called embedded. You know, the reporters are embedded with the Bills, like it's a military unit. So there's a lot of that language out there. I've got a lot of phone calls to work through.
There's a George Carlin bit about it.
Is there?
Oh, yeah, about the language used between baseball and football. And it's an extraordinary bit.
Militaristic?
So baseball uses soft language. Baseball, we make an error. Football, you make a penalty. It's one of the most brilliant language bits ever. But he talks a lot about how the field general leads his men down the field to penetrate the opposition and punch it through the enemy goal line. Baseball, we go home. And it's very, I'm not doing the bit justice, but it is a fantastic.
No, look it up. I didn't know it.
It's a fantastic illustration of this.
I've got a lot of phone calls to work through. So if you're on the line, try to be patient. I'm going to try to get through all of the phone calls. I'm going to start with Carol calling from Canadice. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, Evan. I love your show.
Thanks.
My daughter was state champion in high school and got recruited heavily by D1 schools, went off to a high-level D1 program. And, it didn't take away her love for the game, because that's just strongly in her, but the emotional, psychological abuse that she took along with her teammates. She ended up transferring to another high-level D1 school and kind of experienced the same thing. And, you know, she's a coach now. She has her own training business, and she just approaches it so differently, so much more positively. And, you know, she was raised, you know, with a lot of positive, you know, input. And it was just, it was such a letdown because she was so, so into it. And, you know, she had just high goals. And it was very disappointing to experience.
Carol, what would you say to a coach who might say, look, what you perceive as verbal and emotional abuse is just your daughter being pushed to achieve more, and sometimes it sounds tough, but that's a coaching technique. What would you say to a coach who tried to tell you that?
They did tell.
Okay.
They did tell, you know, and she's a tough person, and she could take a lot, and it didn't get the result. You know, that, I mean, they weren't winning programs. They were high-level schools, but it didn't work. You know, it just it deflated, I think it put her and the team just you know, they didn't play relaxed, and you know, because they were all willing to work really hard, and her included. Oh my gosh! Yeah. I mean, she was always the first in the gym, and you know, just working hard, and had that love and that drive to win, but they had other ideas that what, you know, it wasn't working.
Well, Carol, thank you. I'm sorry for what your family experienced there, but sounds like that perspective serves her well now.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Robin.
Yeah, thank you, Carol, for the phone call. Andre, as a former high-level college athlete yourself, what does that do when you hear an athlete like that who's literally looking for a way out because of what they're experiencing with coaches?
Well, I think that's the best thing to do is to, in any abusive situation, is to get out as soon as possible, especially when you're, and I would tell any high school athlete, if you're getting recruited, do as much research as you can beforehand. Get the perspective of the players. Don't just get the perspective of the assistant coach that's recruiting you. Get the real deal, get the truth, so you can make a solid decision as to where you want to go. It doesn't sound like Carol's daughter did that. It sounds like she was a little bit bamboozled when she got to school, and then things were different than what she expected. So I would just tell people to, you know, do their due diligence and research in terms of recruiting. And then if you are in a bad situation, you need to have a plan as to how you're going to transfer out and get where you got to go in college. And the other thing is if you're in a situation where you can't get out, you can't transfer, maybe you're going to be a senior and it's too late. At the end of the day, just like we're having this conversation in this room, there's nothing wrong with, there's not going to be any kind of change unless you talk about it and have some kind of dialogue go along with it. So like you said, it served her daughter well in the future. And then when you have a chance to take a child and push them beyond where they can push themselves, because that's what a coach's job is, that's great. And you should do that. But you have to find positive ways to get that done, and you'll have a chance to find success. I can almost guarantee you that anybody who has an abusive type of program or has an abusive culture more than likely is running a mediocre program and is not getting the results that they hope for.
And that's exactly, Professor, the point that you had made earlier, that the research that you have analyzed indicates to you that when it is abuse of any kind, the results do not bear success. Because this is a mother who said, yeah, we heard that from the coach, that we're not abusing your daughter. Right. We're pushing her, and that's appropriate. But she said it did not work for her daughter.
Right. Absolutely. And sometimes we have to, even if we want to move back and look a little bit of what's happening locally, because we can also think about maybe there might be some coaches that are inspiring and kind of looking at this idea that they might have this dream of being like a Division I coach or emulating a Division I coach. And sometimes they might, knowing the culture, could sometimes do that, even locally here. So I'm just saying that even though we're having this discussion, they might be locally folks that are doing these kind of things that are somewhat in this abusive kind of context that we're talking about, just you know, high schoolers or even I know you don't do football in middle school, right? You might be somewhere up in a little further up, but the idea that might still be here locally. So therefore, we have to look at that context if we try to bring it back down from the national level and say, what are we doing here in Rochester?
Yeah.
And then see is this culture being perpetuated here at this level here in Rochester? And how could we do that? Because our guests, obviously, we're talking about this and we're seeing that, hey, this is happening on a national level, but how could we look at us? How could we look at how are we doing with our children and how are we perpetuating or not that particular idea?
All right, let me get back to your phone call. Stephen in Rochester next. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, Evan, how are you today?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. Hey, I appreciate ice hockey, and even at the young ages, like your last guest was just mentioning, 10, 12-year-olds, they are using language that I wouldn't even use around my kids. I mean, referring to, you know, female body parts, referring to, you know, let's put down everybody and the swear words, they're getting that from someplace. Most of the time, as an official, you can hear it coming from the coach. You can hear it coming from the parents after the games. That culture is being fed down from college, you know, as your guests are just saying, from the high school level. It works its way into youth sports, and it's being perpetuated. And I've had been fortunate enough to work some national championships, tournaments, and you don't hear that type of language at the championship level because those coaches are the fostering ones that are pushing their teams, having the accountability. So it's a different mindset. It's always the mediocre teams that are having that type of attitude where it's that toxic masculinity with the belittling that goes with it. So it starts young and it moves up through the ranks.
Boy, I'm sorry to hear that, Stephen, and thank you for at least sharing that with us because it's something to be on guard for. But again, I will stress that Andre Fontenot and Derek DeSole said earlier that in their experiences on the college level, they did not generally experience this type of abuse. And we're not just talking physical abuse. We're talking verbal abuse, emotional abuse. They did not. And that that everyone in athletics has probably heard stories like that. But for the most part, I fair to say, Derek, that your experience is that most coaches that you have interacted with, high school level, college level, are not abusing their athletes.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. They most are not abusive. These guys in the news now, they're in the news because they're outliers. There's probably more. There's probably ones we don't know about
because that's always
the case.
Yeah.
But it's making news because it's shocking, because it is still an outlier. And I really do believe that. And I really hope I'm not wrong on that.
Okay, mm-hmm. Andre?
I mean, I coach football at McQuaid Jesuit. I'm an assistant there, and through my coaching college football and 9 years of coaching college football, this coming to be my fourth season at McQuaid, I've never been a part of anything like that, so I've never seen it. I've just read stories like the one that we're talking
about
now.
Would you call it out as a coach who doesn't believe in that now? As a former player and a coach now, if you saw another coach going across a line that you have, would you address it?
To be totally honest with you, I've been the coach who verbally got after the team after a terrible practice. And then I felt so bad, I went back to them the next day and apologized to them after I said, I apologize the way I spoke to you guys. I was frustrated and I was, you know, it was a little bit too much. And you have to be able to know, and you got to be able to know, we're talking about toxic masculinity, you have to be able to know when to apologize when you're wrong too, when you're right and you're wrong. And I also referee Section 5 basketball as well. And I've heard things in the crowd from coaches in basketball, because you're a little bit closer in basketball than you are football. So I've heard certain things from coaches and seen certain cultures in different basketball programs. And you're right. It starts locally. And like Roland said, it starts from the inside, and it has to work its way out in order for us to find some kind of positive change.
I admire the whole idea of going back the next day, because what that reinforces is what Derek said earlier. You let them know, I have your back. I'm here with your best interest in mind. I care about you. Mm-hmm. And if I cross the line out of my frustration, I'm going to own it, and I want you to know that it comes from a place of me caring about you and your growth. Parents have been in that situation. I've apologized to my son and said, I don't like the way I spoke to you. I was frustrated, and you didn't deserve that.
Right.
But I have high expectations of you, but I should not do that. And I think that builds a bridge there.
And I will say this. The only positive thing that came out of it is that Maryland at least has handled it well in terms of immediately they said they take legal and moral
responsibility
for what happened. So at least they didn't say, oh, we'll wait till the investigation goes through this
exactly.
and that.
Exactly.
They took responsibility
immediately. I guarantee you the lawyers did not like
right. But
that
you got to give the university president and the athletic director credit for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, Professor Primus?
I just think that what Andre mentioned, too, is this idea that we have to consider, and even Roland, I think he said he had three sons, but the idea that you can accept those responsibilities and or within Roland's context of raising his children, that he was part of that environment, and now he's looking at that environment and saying, as I'm raising my three boys, that I want it to be a little bit different for those three. And so for Andre to mention that, hey, I will be upset, but yet I'm going to go back, those are the kind of things you have to look at coaching as parenting and not just coaching, because you're parenting children at a very young age. And so where they're influential in terms of high schoolers and even in at the college level. But either way, look at coaching as parenting. Mm-hmm. And that way we can actually think about how do we interact with children rather than just being abusive to towards them.
All right, let me squeeze in a few more phone calls because we've got a lot lined up. So we're going to go quick. We'll listen to several more calls before the hour's out. Linda in Penfield. Go ahead, Linda. Keep it tight.
Hi. Thank you very much for the topic. And when it was mentioned about, well, when is it inspirational or discipline and when does it become abuse? Perhaps if we look at basically that there is a power differential here, much like there's teacher to student or boss to employee, there's also this differential approach to athlete and that the coach is in a position to, you know, have some sort of impact, positive or negative, on that athlete. So I just want to bring that up. Thank you.
Yeah, Linda, thank you. I don't necessarily it's hard to disagree. There is a power dynamic certainly in play. And I appreciate that. Thank you.
But isn't that a great metaphor for life?
Yeah.
I mean, in any management or business relationship, or how many times is somebody has more power? Football could be a tool to teach people how to act in that situation.
Yeah, an opportunity too.
Yeah.
Jim in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon. Look, the University of Maryland has had a history of doing unorthodox things. This isn't a new phenomena for them. A few years back, a historical famous basketball coach there, he's since passed on, Lefty Brazil. I think he won an NCAA championship. But he had to leave with a cloud over his head, or forced to retire, because there were massive recruitment violations, basically taking kids off the street, no academic preparation whatsoever, just to win. So this isn't a new phenomena for that university, and it's tragic that that kid had to lose his life. No 19-year-old should go to any college or university and die from a heat stroke. The NFL, National Football League, just had an experience a few years back with the Minnesota Vikings, a big offensive lineman, had a massive heat stroke. They changed the policies, procedures, two practices a day instead of the long practice. If it gets too hot, we're going to quit. I mean, these are supposed to be astute people. Haven't they learned anything? And besides, one of your guests made it an analogy. College football is not the United States military, where you have to engage an enemy and either kill that enemy or be killed. So that's a false context. This country's not going south. There are some outstanding people in this country. They just have to come to the forefront.
Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And that's a good way to put a little coda on the phone calls and the thoughts from the audience. And in fact, we're down to our last 30 seconds. And so, Andre Fontenette, your former Sarah, I don't know when you and Roland were both at Syracuse. Did you cross paths?
No, nah, Roland's a lot older than me.
A lot older. You want to just...
But I do know Roland. He does a great thing for the Rochester and his Champions Academy. I would continue to promote that all the way through.
Well, 20 seconds. Do you share his enthusiasm or at least his optimism that coaching and masculinity and this kind of culture, this is not going to become the norm, that this is more of an outlier.
Yes, I share his enthusiasm, and I think that we're moving in a positive direction because we're having dialogue, and I know that from experience it starts with me, and we got to go out from the inside working out.
I want my kid coached by the likes of the people at this table.
Go to McQuaid.
Sign him up. Andre Fontenet, we always appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time on this Monday.
Thank you guys for having me.
Derek Tissol, former St. John College football player. We'll talk to you in your many other capacities around town. Nice talking about
subject. Don't be a stranger. This
you
is
got
fun.
It. Appreciate it. And Mark Primus, a clinical assistant professor of social work at Nazareth College. Learned a great deal from you this hour. Thank you, Professor. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.